Thanks, everybody. I'm Nick Gillespie with Reason, and this is our discussion about libertarian populism and its discontents. And we have with us Tim Carney of the Washington Examiner, Ben Domenech of the Transom and of Real Clear Politics,
and
Heartland Institute, and Jesse Walker, also of Reason and the author of the forthcoming book, The United States of Paranoia. Definitely give that a look. What we're going to talk about today for about 30 minutes, the panel will discuss libertarian populism. What is it? Why is it perceived with such interest and such hostility? There was a piece today at Salon recently attacking giving Ayn Rand a pitchfork doesn't make her a populist or possibly a libertarian, whatever, and what its prospects are. Then we'll open it up to some questions for the audience. I want to thank Reason TV for filming this as well. So let's get started with some definitions real quick. Tim, why don't you give us the thumbnail sketch of what libertarian populism is? In many ways, at a column at the Washington Examiner almost a year ago, about 10 months ago, you kind of outlined an idea of populist libertarianism. What did you mean by that?
So it was after the election Romney's 47% comments. What really struck me was Romney thought, the problem here is we can never get working class or poor people to vote for us because we believe in free markets. And I realized that Romney was buying into the very idea that the liberals and
Idea that if you're getting a direct payment from the government or if you're on welfare or some
but
kind
even,
of assistance
but program, for him it was even he was conflating the people who weren't paying high tax rates with who weren't paying income tax with people who were getting a handout. And so that's when I sort of realized Romney's whole play was for kind of the white bread upper middle class people. He thought if you're successful you need to be a Republican. But then when I was out in the field in Ohio, I was like, wait a second, if these people are successful, why are they going to turn against Obama if they've had a good 4 years? And then you look at the economy and the numbers that Obama himself cites. It's like the middle class has stagnated, the working class has stagnated, the corporate profits are at record high. And then you realize regulations entrench the big businesses. Mm-hmm. Bailouts favor the big businesses. Small businesses can't rise. Small businesses are the ones that employ people. And so in short, the game is rigged in America. Government is the one doing the rigging, and it's rigged in favor of the well-connected, the big, and the wealthy.
Okay, so that's the populist angle, is that you're kind of not quite as bad. Those of you who have read The Sound and the Fury will remember Jason Compson's attack on Wall Street. But it's banksters who are in cahoots. They're taking the Acela between New York and D.C., writing the rules to keep themselves in riches. And other people are getting screwed. And what's different about this populism is that you're calling for actual free market reforms, as opposed to
the way to unrig the system is to get government out of it.
Okay. Now, Ben, talk a little bit about your take on libertarian populism.
First off, let me say thank you so much for hosting this. And I have to say, if nothing else comes out of the conversation about libertarian populism than Nick's fantastic excoriation of Paul Krugman, then I think it was still worth it. I definitely
and I rush to say that was merely an excuse to talk about how he doesn't bother reading the people that he criticizes, which is an aspirational position for all of us.
Well, I needed a cigarette afterwards, so thank you. The thing that I think is sort of interesting about libertarian populism is I think it's been sort of a long time coming, and I think it's more about culture than it is about sort of electoral politics. I think that the fusionist sort of agreement that Frank Meyer put forward was something that really led to success on the right for the course of several generations for a number of reasons. And it started with a commonly held vision of what a life well lived looked like. Essentially that you would come out of high school or college, you would get married, you would have kids, you would buy a house, you would buy a car, you would live in the suburbs, they would go to a good school, et cetera, et cetera. All of these different things had an effect in terms of driving you towards at least small C conservatism or limited government in a number of different ways. You started caring about not just property taxes, but you maybe had an interaction with the teachers at your school that made you think differently about public education. You started caring about what was on TV. You started caring about the future of the world that you were living in and caring about the Soviet Union in that context and the danger that it represented. All of these different things bound together a cohort of individuals across the country who had a certain vision of what a life well-lived looked like. What we've seen in the wake of the downfall of the Soviet Union and the Berlin Wall coming down is that essentially the Republican Party as a whole, of course, has only won the popular vote in a presidential election once since then, and they did so in the one election where they had a stand-in for the now absent USSR in the form of the threat of Islamic terrorism. In fact, what we've seen is a complete change in the way that Americans view the life well lived. We've seen a delaying of marriage, a delaying of childbirth. We've seen situations where now many of the people in this room, you're going to have more jobs by the time that you're 30 than your grandparents had their entire lives. You're going to move all over the place as opposed to staying near home. Because of this, you have different priorities, different policy priorities, and you're threatened by different things in terms of the encroachment of big government and big business, the sorts of things that Tim was talking about. What I think that we're seeing here is the rise of a new era of individualism in America, and I think with that comes the prioritization of individual liberty and a rejection on the part of many of the people who formerly endorsed compassionate conservatism, a lot of Christian evangelicals who sort of were engaging in this do-gooder paternalism are now turning against that and reconsidering it.
So are you saying, though, that, I mean, this new rise of individualism, is this a more inclusive ideal where if you're gay, if you're black, if you're living an alternative lifestyle, Rand Paul talked a while ago about how the Republican Party, if it's going to win, has to include people who have tattoos, who have ponytails, who have black nail polish, stuff like that?
I think it is more tolerant. And I think that there are a lot of, particularly, I would say, evangelical Christians who are judging harshly the sort of Santorum-esque approaches that they may have adopted in the past, and instead realizing that religious liberty, individual liberty, the liberty of families to raise their children in the way that they see fit is something that has to be prioritized in the kind of circumstance that we exist today.
Yeah, that the idea of trying to use civil law to advance church teachings is something that has backfired, and instead what the fight in Washington is about is making it keeping it legal for us to live as Christians. That's part of it from the sort of social perspective.
Do you and before we get to Jesse, who will give us a kind of perspective on populism as well as libertarianism, in that you guys each would define yourselves more as conservatives than as libertarians, right?
I've always considered myself a Christian libertarian in a sort of small, rural sense. I like homeschoolers, I like raw milk, and I like, sort of people being left alone with their guns on their farms. And so that's sort of the way that I've used it.
I'm a libertarian from 9 to 5, and then I get home and I'm a conservative.
Okay, well, I feel sorry for your wife and kids, but all of the wives and all of the kids. But, Jesse, talk a little bit about when you hear this type of stuff. How are you seeing that as it plays out in a kind of longer tradition of populism in America, which generally, not exclusively, but generally comes from the left probably, and is more collectivist by definition than individualist.
Yeah, I mean, populism is one of those words that people use in so many different ways that it starts to lose meaning, and yet it has meaning. There's a reason why people reach for that word. I mean, I've always kind of liked the word. A lot of it also, I mean, that Michael Lind piece you mentioned, I starts quoting the Populist Party platform of the 1890s, which is often, it's a good place to start, but it kind of neglects the way in which even the Populist Party was a sort of odd big tent, which had people ranging from Hamlin Garland, who was a big Herbert Spencer fan and about 80% libertarian, though he's into some things like the Georgist land tax as well, all the way out to people who are followers of Edward Bellamy and wanted the state to run everything. So there's from the beginning, populism has meant all kinds of different things. One useful distinction, Lawrence Goodwin, who wrote a book called Democratic Promise, which was a history of the Populist Party, he wrote it in sort of the New Left period, and it's drenched in that whole ambiance, and it's been supplanted as scholarship in a lot of ways. But he made an interesting distinction in it between what he called authentic populism and shadow populism. Authentic populism being this initial movement of people, of farmers who were trying to form cooperatives and change the laws in ways that would let their what they were building thrive. And the shadow populists being the people who sort of signed on with William Jennings Bryan and the sort of the gimmicky Free Silver Crusade and the Democratic Party and what Goodwin called hierarchical politics. And like I said, that's really a simplification of the Populist Party, but it's an interesting distinction to draw when you're talking about populism since then, since it cuts across left-right lines, libertarian, authoritarian lines, centralist, decentralist lines. You've got, on the one hand, this long tradition of sort of the people will rule. this idea of how do we restore power to individuals and communities, which is very much not just a matter of populist rhetoric, but this whole tradition of people who are not professional political activists, who have volunteer-driven groups that are run entirely or almost entirely by people who are, it's part-time. They have jobs elsewhere, you know. And then there's this other idea of, like, the People's Tribune, the politician who exploits that kind of anger. I mean, your Huey Longs and so on, who are part of what comes to mind when you talk about populism, and who themselves then, I mean, someone like Huey Long is, like, concentrating power in order to attack other power that's concentrated elsewhere, but now you can have someone like Hillary Clinton or John Edwards just sort of, you say something kind of rabble-rousing and people call you a populist. So how this comes around to libertarian populism, I mean, what we can say to make sense of that sort of combination of phrases is that if you're talking about populism as a challenge to concentrated power, then libertarianism matches it very well. I think that and when you talk about being a libertarian populist, if you mean that as sort of a double-edged sword, is that you're a libertarian and that you're for greater individual freedom and people being able to make choices about their lives, and you're a populist in the sense of wanting to break up this sort of nexus of state and corporate power, and also this sort of bureaucratic, so much of what we think of as a free market economy is actually just drenched in the state, whether it's banking, insurance, and so on. And I think there's a lot of resentment against things like health insurance companies and so on, which can be turned in a libertarian direction when people like Tim sort of present libertarian reforms.
I think I'm just glad that you brought up Huey Long. You know, just to compare two lines together, obviously, every man a king and that sort of conversation. I've always thought of the Coolidge line as being kind of the response to that. You know, the Constitution did not eliminate the divine right of kings. Things that asserted the divine right of all men. And so because of that, I think you reach sort of a populist ideal around the idea that the threat doesn't just come from big government. You know, conservatives have been railing about big government for forever, but it comes also from other big entities as well who have used government to assert their own power.
Does this reduce libertarian populism more to a kind of rhetoric, though? I mean, in some way, it seems like an episode of King of the Hill, where, you know, Hank Hill goes from getting beaten up by the local regulators to Megalomart, where there's a giant corporation that that runs everything. And is that mostly what you guys are pushing back against? I mean, is it bigness per se, or does it matter if it's big business versus big government?
Some of it is going to be rhetoric and a positive rhetorical change and a positive sort of attitude. In other words, it's not just rhetoric. It's not hating people who have low incomes, like Mitt Romney hates people who have low incomes.
But, do you think he hates them, or they don't exist?
He wrote them off and said they could not be Republicans, and so that's part of it. And then part of it is going to be policy choices, as Jesse said. We're in this world where the sort of initial position is so mixed up with government that what is the libertarian? And Jesse had blogged a little bit about my idea that the banks are too big and they need to be broken up. And yesterday at the Examiner, I put up a blog post. I said, look, A, the banks are as big as they are, the mega banks, in part because of government privilege granted them through implicit bailouts, explicit bailouts, and regulation that acts as a moat around them. That was Jamie Dimon's exact word to describe Dodd-Frank. It's a moat. B, we know that their being that big will lead to a bailout when they fail. So when you're a libertarian, you come out this and you say, so we let them stay this big, or now that we know there are these subsidies, maybe we tweak these subsidies to prevent them from being that big or limit their ability to access a bailout. So there's
very quickly, though, how do you break up the banks without creating a regulatory system that is going to immediately be recuperated into propping them up again, et cetera?
And so what I say is...
And also with a huge political constituency for that. I mean, TARP was never, by most public opinion surveys, it was probably not widely understood, but it was never widely popular, and yet everybody knew it was going to happen.
So the banks have standing privileges from the government, some of which are explicit, and those can be tweaked. So FDIC insurance, Fed lending window stuff. There are people who know more about bank policy who have commented on this. Thomas Honig is one of them, who said that these privileges for the banks should be curtailed. And because the government is both explicitly and implicitly the insurer, the government can go ahead and set limits on their size. So this is a way of saying, of acknowledging the reality, it might be impossible to get rid of all the government privileges for the banks. So given that they exist – we're not going to regulate them. We're not going to give some regulators some new power. We're just going to say you no longer get access to this government privilege above this size. So it's taking away some of the government privilege and reducing the chance of a future bailout. So that's libertarian populism going in a different direction from what a libertarianism might go if it wasn't aimed at taking on the large beneficiaries of government privilege.
Isn't this really about sort of getting rid of large institutions' ability to insulate themselves from risk and to socialize that risk to the rest of us? And yeah. I think in terms of your question about policy, an area where this is obvious is a gas and groceries-based agenda. We have more subsidies, mandates, quotas, and tariffs in place that affect the price of gas and groceries than almost any other area of the economy. That impacts every single American's pocketbook when they go and they shop for their family.
Well, let's
priorities. You make sugar, getting rid of the sugar program, a priority because that would lower the price of groceries if we got rid of that subsidy.
Now, what about other kind of specific policy recommendations that come out of this? So, Tim, you've written about abolishing the payroll tax. What happens, you know, I think everybody would be like, okay, well, that would be great. That would save me, you know, 12.5% or 14% or whatever of my paycheck. But then on the backside of that, it's like, okay, that also, does that mean we get rid of Social Security and Medicare and other entitlements that seem to have a wide, you know, a populist constituency and, in fact, themselves were earlier emanations of populist sentiment?
Yeah, and so you start by saying the Republican priority has for years been lowering the top income tax rates. And I want to lower all income tax rates. I think it should be a priority to get rid of the taxes that affect your first dollar. Before you're feeding your kid, before I'm paying for the diapers for my kids, then I'm paying into Medicare, which, by the way, is funding Warren Buffett's health care. So you switch that priority. And you maybe means test some of these entitlements, if that makes sense. And then as far as do you want to undo Medicare? Do you want to undo Social Security? Ideally, you do. But this is the sort of thing where libertarian populism sets a priority and says, no, we're not going to say we're not going to focus on pushing grandma off the cliff because there's a limited amount
unless
of political capital.
Unless she can afford her own parachute.
Unless she can afford her own parachute. There's a limited amount of political capital, and we're going to spend that on the things that reduce government and help the people, the middle class and the working class.
In the context of the farm bill that was recently pushed through, was it a mistake then to split the farm bill where you have farm subsidies in one and food stamps in another, and to do farm subsidies first and to back farm subsidies as opposed to do food stamps and actually allow food stamps?
I think that Ross Douthat had it correct in the sense that this was sort of the worst of both world situations. The Republicans once again showed their willingness to defend ag subsidies to the hilt, you know, and in a way that, again, you know, enforces the bigs and raises the prices for the rest of us. And I just want to point out, you know, I think within this broader conversation, you know, I talked a little bit about the rise of individualism. The other thing that we're seeing is the rise of individual employment, of self-employment within this economy. There's enormous regulatory burdens and biases within not just the tax code, but within the whole of the state when it comes to licensing and everything else that comes with that, that is biased enormously against that kind of innovative work. This is another example of how libertarian populism is about saying we want to have more competition within a marketplace. We want to open this up and have more people coming in and risking their own capital in order to make gains and not have a system that is biased in favor of the people who can hire the lawyers and the attorneys to help them navigate it.
Jesse?
I have a question for the two spokespeople for libertarian populism here, which is that I'm really kind of confused on one topic because there seems to be a lot of slippage back and forth, and I just put together this long reading list on libertarian populism for Hit and Run yesterday, and sometimes it's specifically referring to this idea of free market populism, and other times there seems to be this sort of three-legged stool. I mean, it combines the anti-corporatist economics with the new sort of movement towards like an anti imperial foreign policy vision and an interest in civil liberties, at least on the federal level, that you're sort of getting from people like Justin Amash. And so are we talking about a broad libertarian in things outside economics, or are we talking, I mean, you brought up culture earlier, but I mean, you didn't talk about a program in that context.
Well, I actually do think that it's the whole, I think this is the new fusionism. I think this is the new three-legged stool.
So then explain, I think we have a sense of the economic priorities and policies. How does that play out in things like foreign policy or national security? And then cultural issues, especially because you both have identified yourselves as Christian-leaning. I mean, I assume that implies, and I know Tim you know, being anti-abortion and whatnot.
Sure.
How does this play in?
First off, I think that the elites in Washington are becoming more and more aware that the base has learned, has taken lessons from the last 10 years, and that lesson is leading them more towards anti-interventionism, more towards skepticism of not just the power of the state. I think you see in the Pew poll that came out most recently about the complete shift that you've seen in Tea Party opinions of security programs and things of that nature. And then on the social issues, and I'll let Tim speak to this as well, I think there's a greater understanding that a federalist approach to these issues is a wiser one, and that what's more, when it comes to these issues, it's again more about the liberty of individuals and families to direct their own path, as opposed to sort of a top-down shift along other lines.
So, and on that, I just want to comment on that Pew poll. The Tea Party big shift in civil liberties was not from Bush to Obama.
Right,
it was from 2010 to now. Still under Obama, most Republicans were rah-rah for spying, and that now, basically,
and
since
clearly
the filibuster,
a lot of them still are. I mean, the long knives are coming out for people like Rand Paul, from a GOP establishment that is saying, look, this guy's McGovern
and
2.0.
Dave Weigel had a great article pointing out that this was Christie playing to the GOP donor base.
Right.
So the GOP elites are not going to be on board with a foreign policy and domestic security libertarianism. It will take a fight against the elites, something you might call populism, in order to advance this libertarian national security and foreign policy.
This argument has been avoided for far too long by the elites who pretended that this disagreement didn't exist because they are afraid of the fact that the people who largely send their kids overseas to fight these wars are skeptical about them.
How does this play out in terms of a question like immigration? Ben, you've written that part of libertarian populism would be building and enforcing a border fence. Tim, you seem to kind of go back and forth in terms of, I mean, you're not an open borders enthusiast. So, you know, this is another question where immigration can be seen as, you know, you're helping out the little guy by keeping these, you know, hordes of people coming who are, you know, going to cut grass and do low-wage jobs for cheap. Or it can also be that we're going to create, in order to maintain, the integrity of the national citizenry, we're going to create a massive E-Verify system that every freaking American has to go through. Where do you guys end up in immigration?
Do you want to take it first?
So, yeah, I mean, I'm totally a squish, meaning I have no idea what my policy prescription would be on immigration, because obviously if somebody wants to come to this country and live and work, we shouldn't stop them. But the immigration proposals put forward by both parties that end up being compromises end up being these basically what business demands. There's people, some people want open borders, some people want closed borders. So the compromise is a Chamber of Commerce proposal to only bring in people to work specific jobs to fill these labor shortages, which is effectively big business trying to use government policy to drive down the cost of labor, which is not something I support. But on the other hand, if people want to come here and work and live, what kind of populist would I be if I said, no, you can't come here? So, or what kind of libertarian would I be? So,
My ideal would be an open border and no welfare state. But the reality, I think, that we face here is that that's unlikely to happen. I think within the immigration bill, you know, as Tim said, the problem is that you essentially have this cronyist arrangement where the stakeholders at the table are the chamber and La Raza, and they want to divvy up the jobs and run the wage scales from Washington. I think that's the wrong direction to go in. And I think that immigration is a problem in the long term. But the bigger problem from my perspective is, you know, you've heard the trope about their jobs Americans won't do. That's not generally true, except there are jobs that Americans won't do if the entitlement state pays them more not to do it. And that's what you see in the population in Detroit and elsewhere who have been sitting around on their duffs as opposed to moving to a place where there's jobs.
I don't know that there are that many apples to pick with a Detroit proper.
Exactly.
So,
more and more each day.
And deer to kill.
Jesse, how does the politics of immigration play out traditionally or historically in immigration or immigration debates and populism?
Well, I mean, one form that populism takes is scapegoating outsiders. And immigrants are often the outsiders to get scapegoated. That's the ugly side of populism, I think. And I think that, I mean, I'm for open borders. It's probably my least popular political opinion. Of course, from the point of view of, I think Tim actually makes a really good point about these compromises that include things like E-Verify and these sorts of arrangements where people can come and work here, but they can't switch jobs, they can't start their own business. It's really like the wrong approach to immigration reform. But, you know, I mean, I don't want to be playing to the people who just hate Mexicans, you know, and that's...
And actually, this might be way too pie in the sky, but an idea for how do you make inroads as if... So, you guys are not Republicans, but a lot of the audience I write for is people who say, how do Republicans get back to a majority? How do you make inroads into a minority population? Maybe if you become more explicitly the party of business owners, you do that. Immigrants... Especially,
you mean small business owners?
Yeah, small business owners. Immigrants are much more likely to start a business than native-born Americans. And if you own a business that's decently successful, you become something of a neighborhood leader. So if you become the one who the Korean grocer and the Salvadoran restaurant owner, if they come out there and they clearly see that the Republican Party and the free market movement and the libertarian movement is on their side, then they can become community leaders who then can bring people around with them.
Well, don't the Republicans, though, I mean, one of the things that strikes me as odd is they're always like, how do we win the Latino vote and all of this? And it's like, between George W. Bush and Rick Perry, they have two models of a major state with a very heavy Latino population who are getting 40% or more in running. And I think, you know, first is that unlike, you know, I think everybody, including Mitt Romney, most of his sons would agree he was the worst candidate ever. But you don't talk about deporting people immediately. You might learn how to speak Spanish. You might, you know, be willing to shake hands with Hispanics. You know, it doesn't seem that complicated. And you create a world in which they can kind of get along and work and, you know, and live.
I think you're completely right on that front. And just my father is Puerto Rican. My perspective on this is simply that the Republican Party for years has been sending they have no cultural awareness to the degree that they will send Cubans to try to sell free market ideas to Mexicans and not understand what they're doing wrong. And there is something just sort of about that basic understanding. But I think that there is something, you know, sort of more meaningful going on here, too, in the sense that This immigration conversation is an important one, but think about, again, how the immigration process started. It started with the stakeholders around a table, and the stakeholders were the bigs. They were the unions. They were the big businesses. That is who this policy was formed to have feel like it's pleased. That's why you see the elites of the Republican Party right now saying, we're going to spend a slew of money to slam this thing through. It's never about what's actually good for the middle and lower class, for the small business owner, et cetera. It's not the right priorities in terms of who you're looking to.
It's fascinating because George Bush actually, I mean, essentially everything that's being talked about now, Bush had pushed earlier in 2005 or 2006. What was different there was that the unions were not involved at all, and now the SEIU in particular has kind of flipped and is willing to talk about comprehensive immigration reform.
Exactly.
Let's talk about, and we'll get to questions in a few minutes, but let's talk about the prospects of this. The Republican Party, and, you know, first we'll talk about this, how this is playing out in the Republican Party, and then we'll ask a question which I think Jesse will lead on as to whether or not, it's not whether or not this is a good strategy for the Republicans to win the White House, but the real question, at least for most reason, I think, readers and certainly staffers, is can the GOP actually be libertarian in any way, shape, or form? But there is clearly a pushback against this kind of libertarianism. When you look at people like Justin Amash, when you look at people like Rand Paul, they are, as they rise in profile, they're being attacked by establishment candidates. Is this something that the Republican Party, which needs some kind of reboot, are they willing to actually kind of channel their inner libertarian or their inner populist?
Yeah, so the way you win in politics is not by convincing people in power to agree with you, but by convincing them that it's in their interest to act like they agree with you. And when Rand Paul went on that floor and the magic of Twitter and Facebook and emails and phone calls, all of a sudden every Republican senator needed to realize that they need to pretend like they agreed with Rand Paul.
Well, when you see Mitch McConnell kind of float up into a filibuster about drone strikes, you know, something odd has happened.
Yeah, and Mitch McConnell voted against the farm bill in the Senate. Mitch McConnell and leadership voted against reauthorizing the Export-Import Bank of the United States. And so there is certainly this idea among the leadership where they feel pressure from the libertarian populism, frankly, that's going on. So I think it does certainly have promise.
I think that the promise that I see here is that the primary pushback is coming from, I mean, I worked with Mike Gerson and Pete Wehner in the Bush White House, in the speechwriting office. I disagreed with them then, and I disagree with them even more vehemently now. They're essentially trying to sell a warmed-over version of compassionate conservatism as the way forward. I would argue that 2004 is not a replicable event. Without the threat outside, without the need to have that bat signal up in the sky that says we need a cold-hearted Republican to come in and brutalize some terrorists, they're not going to be able to actually proceed along these lines. And I think that, frankly, this is something that we're putting out to the marketplace to test. You know, if this really is going to work, if it's going to be the way forward, then I think you're going to see more and more people cling to it.
Jesse, let me ask you this in terms of broadening from just the discussion of Republicans. You know, Chris Christie, when he attacked Rand Paul recently, said, you know, there's this dangerous libertarian strain coursing through both parties. When you look at people like Glenn Greenwald, who has, you know, really brought a national security questions to bear, also had written a drug policy, a drug decriminalization study for the Cato Institute. Does this also have the ability, do you think, to reach across to independents or left-leaning Democrats who are kind of sick of the Democratic Party?
Well, I think an even better thing to look at is, you know, who voted for the Amash proposal. Mm-hmm. I mean, that cut both on both sides, it threw both parties. And I have even less hope of the Democratic Party turning towards libertarian populism than I do of the Republican Party, which is just about nil. I think you'd have to go back to the 70s to see like a bunch of Democrats actually seriously engaging this idea when people like Fred Harris talk about abolishing the ICC. I mean, those days are long past us. But I think in general, you don't want to put all your eggs in one basket. You want to have left-right alliances. You want to find ways to both reach out to the people who feel like they're natural Republicans because they believe in free enterprise, but they start to realize that this sort of corporatist cozy arrangement is not the same as free competition. And on the flip side, there are people on the left who dislike being pushed around by large institutions and are, think about the bizarre health insurance situation we have in this country where a whole bunch of regulations and tax incentives, both because of them, all this healthcare spending not only gets channeled through health insurance, but then you're almost guaranteed to have to get your health insurance through your job. And think about the ways that makes people afraid to leave their jobs and more at the mercy of their bosses. God forbid they want to go start their own business and self-insure. This is the sort of concerns that people on the left have, and these are the sorts of concerns that there's actually a very large libertarian literature for how to deal with. So,
you know, that's something like Obamacare, which promises to say, you know what, you can go get health care.
Well, you know what you wind up having is a liberalism that says we're not really going to break down these big institutions, but we'll help you afford to deal with them, and we're not going to get rid of these things that raise the cost of living, but if you jump through the right amounts of hoops, we'll give you some subsidies. And I think that's a really stunted vision of populism that we could outdo.
Their vision is one of regulation and of subsidy. It's very similar to the technocratic Republican vision. I think libertarian populism would offer something that is different from both of those and that would give those people an answer to their problem, I think, along the lines of what you've diagnosed, that is different and that is new, and that I actually think that will have some appeal.
And I can't see the Democratic Party actually moving away from the corporatism they have. I mean, Obama's probably less corporatist than whoever the Democratic nominee, and Obama's pretty corporatist. I wrote a book about it right there. And Hillary would be much more corporatist. Marty O'Malley as a governor has been. I mean, maybe there's a Russ Feingold out there in the Democratic Party who would be an anti-corporatist with some libertarian streak in him, but I don't see it. I think there's actually more flexibility for Republicans to move away from corporatism than for Democrats to move away.
Is there any possibility, I guess, shortly before they both left office, Ron Paul and Barney Frank, pushed legislation to legalize marijuana or get rid of federal prohibition on marijuana. Is that, are those viable opportunities? Somebody like Rand Paul, and he got Mitch McConnell to sign on to legalizing industrial hemp in Kentucky and whatnot. Are those, how much do those kinds of issues, which aren't as big ticket as foreign policy or, entitlements, does that matter in any of this?
I think it does matter to a degree, and I think that you'll see it at the state level. Within the next couple of years, Texas could easily legalize pot. And I think that one of the things that we'll see, over the course of this conversation is that there's going to be some surprising conversations that happen in normally considered sort of conservative states that have since become more interested in individual liberty in areas like that.
Jesse, and I guess let's have a quick run through. We'll move from Jesse towards me. You know, do you think that the Republican Party is the natural vehicle for this kind of libertarian populism, and will they actually, you know, will they bring at least a candidate to the finish line to for an up or down vote from Americans?
No, I don't. I think there's a niche in there that some people like Amash are creating for libertarian leaning Republicans. I agree with what Tim said that, you know, it's more important to build a movement that can pressure people who don't agree with you than to elect people who agree with you. But at the moment, I feel like we're mostly what we'll get out of them is lip service. I'd like to build this to the point where we can get more than we've gotten so far. I mean, showing up at a filibuster is great, but you know that hasn't stopped any drone strikes.
I agree with you that it's difficult to make that prediction right now, but my position is simply that they're going to have to change in order to survive, and that because of that, the push to individualism, the different priorities that people are going to have is going to push more and more people in that direction. So you may not get a nominee out of it, but I think you'll end up with a pretty sizable faction.
The ugly truth is that a libertarian populism movement would need to find a big donor class that's different from the current donor class of K Street and the business PACs. And there's some of that. The Club for Growth, Freedom Works, those guys all get that money. Is it enough to run a presidential race? And would the current donor class then get on board with a more libertarian party if it looked like they were going to take over the GOP?
Yep. Okay, well, thank you. Thanks for your comments, guys. Let's start some questions, and we'll start with Terry Michael, the one of maybe three libertarian Democrats. Six Democrats. Okay, so please give your question, and then I'll re-articulate it. Yeah. What?
No. Okay. Let me, here you go. Thank you. By the way, when I left my house on Capitol Hill, I ran into Ross Douthat out pushing his baby in a stroller. I tried to get him to ditch the kid and come here, but it did not work. He was pulling daddy duty. For the last 7 years, I've been trying, thanks to Nick and Reason, to insinuate libertarian ideas into the Democratic Party. People say I'm selling at windmills. I've lost a lot of friends. What do you mean, a Democrat and a libertarian? But I still have... I used to be press secretary for the DNC back in the dark ages in the 80s, so I still have a view that we got to make public policy through these two imperfect instruments, and I'm all for the independents to try to tweak that message, but it seems to me that I get a lot better chance of getting libertarian ideas into the Democratic Party than you do the Republican Party, if that's your motive. And here's why. It's government. This is the iteration of the Cato thing, out of my bank account, away from my body, out of the bedroom, and the hell out of Baghdad and the rest of the backyards of the rest of the world. Democrats in the electorate accept those last three things. Not the DuPont Circle FVL-CIO wing of the Democratic Party, because they're as war profiteering as you can get. But I understand it's really hard to get the Nancy Pelosi's of the world, the reactionary left liberals on economics, to fit into that point. But on the other hand, in the Republican Party, you have the neocon nuts still grabbing the party by the scrotum. You have the militarist, Christianist-based Republican Party in the South, still with its radical social cultural conservatism. And you got lip service to free markets.
Well,
so tell me your motive here. I know my motive is to insinuate Democratic Party libertarian ideas.
First, I look at polls about, you know, liberal Democrats and drone strikes and that sort of thing, and I think you'll see the voting populace is not that libertarian on foreign policy. I think even the electorate. But then also, because I didn't address your earlier comment about abortion, I'll take this comment. A libertarian isn't an anarchist. A libertarian believes that if the government has a proper role, it's to defend the vulnerable against violence. And a baby inside a womb is about as vulnerable as they get, and an abortion is an act of violence. So I know that not everybody in this room agrees with this. I know that you probably think Ron Paul was one of your favorite members of the House, Rand Paul one of your favorite members of the Senate. Pro-life can fit firmly in a libertarian movement. I agree that a lot of Christian conservatives go too far and become statists, but I think that that's rolling back, especially as they see that the fight for over the cultural issues is a fight for religious liberty by Christians who want it to not be illegal to live as Christian conservatives.
And just to give a little bit of skepticism, I mean, Ron Wyden is obviously somebody who agrees with a lot of, I think, things from Tim and a lot of people in this room when it comes to skepticism of the power of government and how much it's invaded people's privacy. And yet on healthcare issues, you know, I view him as somebody who I could never work with on those. And so I think there are problems in terms of applying both things. I agree with Tim's statement about the pro-life issue generally.
Well, I think the, you know, these alliances have to be modular. You know, I mean, I'm delighted to work with Ron Wyden. I'm not working with him. I'm glad to have my proxies working with him in the areas where it makes sense and to not. And the same applies to, you know, to Rand Paul. You know, who I don't agree with about everything. You know.
Hi, John Glazer, antiwar.com. I have two quick questions. The first one is, I'm a little confused as to why we need a new name for this. Doesn't sound like libertarian populism, whatever your interpretation of those two words are. Just sounds like libertarians, and I think libertarians would do well, especially, you know, people who like reason and like Cato, to call it what it is and what it's always been, which is libertarianism. The second quick question is, if this, to the extent that this represents an actual shift, what do you think was the trigger? Was it the excesses of Bush or the excesses of Obama, or was it purely the economic crisis, or was it post 9/11 policies and so forth?
I'll answer the first half of that question very quickly. What's the Ayn Rand essay, The Virtue of Greed, The Virtue of Selfishness? Yeah, so, and I had friends who drove around their Galtmobile back when we were all Randians with dollar bills waving from the antennas, that a lot of libertarianism, the emphasis and the rhetoric has focused on, you know, millionaires are awesome, let them keep doing that. And some of it is just a rhetoric, but not just that, but it also is pairing it with some of a moral understanding that we do, in fact, there is a moral obligation to, you know, look out for and care for the poor. The government shouldn't be doing it, but saying, you know, we need to limit the role of government and we need to make sure that society isn't, you know, screwing over the people who are worse off. That some of the emphasis, some of the things you engage in outside of politics is going to change compared to what, and there's nothing, hopefully, unlibertarian about it. That's why it can be libertarian populism. It's a strain of it, but it's refocusing its energies.
The trigger is the consequence of the Bush years. It's 2006 to 2009, and the lessons that limited government conservatives took from that, in the sense of mismanagement of not just two wars, but Katrina, losing the status of the Republican Party as the adult in the room. I think that a lot of that prompted them to sort of look seriously at what they had been considering before as Part
and
D as well. Yeah.
Let me throw in two more ideas. Is that, first of all, it when you say libertarian populism, libertarian is modifying populism. It's saying this is a libertarian approach to breaking up concentrated power. I think the phrase makes sense on that level. And also, I mean, just beyond, I mean, I never went through a Rand phase, so I never had a Galtmobile. But I mean, there is this sort of.
I admit it, you could never afford one.
I never, yeah. I drove it into a gulch anyway, so. But there is this sort of strain of what you might call sort of a frat boy libertarianism, which is like, you know, they want to have the right to party, they want to have keep the money to party with, and, you know, party on, dude, you know, it's whatever. But at the same time, you know, there's a they haven't actually thought much about what freedoms other people are missing, and what this sort of institutional environment that the state has created is. And I think some libertarians could afford to have that. Whether libertarian populism is the best label for, or, you know, that sort of refocusing is up in the air. I mean, I didn't coin the word, but I think that is something. I mean, in that sort of focusing libertarianism, so it does stay libertarianism. That means not forgetting this populist or whatever you want to call it side of it.
You know, if I can add to that too, I mean, I think certainly at Reason, and I'm sure at Cato and other free market groups, it's libertarianism that we're interested in, and so the idea of a populism that's participating in that rhetoric is good. But, you know, more broadly in the country, I think that the you know, undeniable continuity between the Bush years and the Obama years, the policies, whether it was TARP, the bailouts, you know, stimulus, which started under Bush and then continued under Obama, national surveillance, war, foreign policy. It's like, holy cow, this is, you know, really it is us little guys against them, the power elites, and that's helped refocus the debate in a positive way. Let's have a question back here, and then we'll come up. Okay, please identify yourself and.
Hi, Lori Sanders with R Street. Hi, Ben. Hi, Tim. Hi, Jesse.
Hi.
So, question. I think that, like, so I obviously think this stuff is great, but it also seems to me to be an overwhelmingly male narrative. And this room seems to be overwhelmingly male. Now, it's a narrative that I agree with. I'm here. I work in the libertarian movement. But I'm curious your thoughts, other than education policy, where I do think you have a clear win with women against teachers' unions, against the type of bureaucracy you deal with your child going to school. Other than with education, how does this narrative of, you know, I'm fighting back against the man who's holding me down, it doesn't really appeal to me as a woman.
I have great news for you on that front, and that's that I acknowledge that problem. I actually have started a libertarian populist women's Google group. We have about 30 women on it.
Now, I see a problem with this right away.
And among them, you include professional women, women of various experience in terms of age and childbirth and everything along those lines. Around the idea of tailoring policies to meet that. Within that, I think we have particularly focused on the rise of working women, particularly the return of working moms to the workforce in the wake of wage stagnation, and how much of a regulatory burden is put on them, not just through the tax code in terms of taxing them at their spouse's level and taking more out of their out of that, but also on the health insurance front, on the child care front, where you can't actually exempt more than $3,000 in child care expenses, which nowhere close to what most of them need. And so there's a host of different issues that are within that set, but it's a problem that I think I'm already well aware of, and I think a lot of the rest of us.
My wife wishes that being taxed at my level was more of a problem than it is. But she also wishes, she's a stay-at-home mom, and she wishes that neighbor kids, her babysitting them for pay, did not involve dealing with Marty O'Malley and with the IRS in the insane ways that it does. There are lots of ways in which the entrepreneur, the small business, the woman working from home baking cakes, Rick Perry thankfully repealed a bill in Texas that basically it had been the baking companies had said, we don't want people to be able to sell cakes they bake from their house. Now, maybe I'm the worst sexist in the world for implying that women bake more cakes from their house, but I bet if you look at it statistically, they do. Women are more likely to take care of kids at their house.
So this is the Mildred Pierce law?
Yes.
Let me give one more example. During the conversation about birth control during the last election, I had a back and forth with some of these more socially conservative women who disliked something that I had said about essentially that you should have, that the way to get rid of this problem is to make all birth control be available over the counter, just like you would purchase aspirin. Nobody thinks that it should be free, but you do want to have access. As a pushback against what Obama was proposing, a lot of the social conservatives at the time were pushing back against me, but I warned them, in the wake of this election, they're going to make Plan B available over the counter for everybody. And sure enough, now we're coming back and having this conversation again. Jindal has endorsed, you know, putting it all over the counter. That's a libertarian populist solution. The employer shouldn't have to pay for it. You should have to pay for it, but you should be able to get it because it's everywhere
and
anyway.
You don't need the intermediary of a doctor and big pharma, et cetera. Yeah. Fred Smith?
A little pushback here. I'm from Louisiana, and so I've had experience with populism. And yes, indeed, populism is wonderful at breaking up the big corporate monoliths. It destroyed every industry in Louisiana, bankrupt the states, but it didn't drive the welfare state out, and it's now a corrupt. It's a banana republic without bananas, okay? It seems to me that politics is about interest groups, and to write off bigness per se, you haven't written off the big Democratic Party or the big Republican Party, but you've immediately seemingly written off big business. It seems to me that the politics is a Baptist and bootlegger, the ideological interest groups and the economic interest groups, and we certainly worry about the use that the economic interest groups are now playing in politics. But isn't there if we're willing to proselytize the Democrats and the Republicans, shouldn't we proselytize elements of the business community, try to find those who are benefited by economic liberalization and find a counter strategy? Because to write off economic groups leaves you with ideological groups. And as far as I know, Hitler, Pol Pot, Mao Zedong, and Stalin did not do it for the money.
Populism is often used by liberals. I'll use another term used by liberals, solidarity. Business solidarity will drive us towards libertarianism. When the businesses are going out lobbying for their own narrow self-interest, they often are pushing for the regulations and the subsidies. This is why the chamber, in I think, frankly, a majority of what the Chamber of Commerce lobbies for ends up being free markets, because there's no regulation that broadly benefits the whole market. Even if it broadly benefits DuPont or whatever, it doesn't broadly benefit the whole market.
They did back the bailouts, didn't they?
So opposing regulation, the chamber has always been on our side. When it comes to spending and corporate welfare, the chamber is often on the big government side. But that's why I think sort of, us Baptists up on the stage need to sort of make sure these guys say, let's have solidarity between this. And when we're fighting against anti-regulation, we're also going to fight against the bailouts and for free markets. And I think a lot of the businesses can be won over, and even some of the business lobbies can be won over. But right now they go out there and they say, look, it's the Republicans and Democrats are both just handing out favors. So why are we going to take some principled stand instead of just getting our favors from both parties? It's your fault.
It's my fault, and it's the fault of all of our groups. We have sort of had the same disdain for economic interests that the left has. And as a result, when they stand up, they're all by themselves. They go back to their foxholes.
Where, for the libertarian populace on the dais, where do you stand on the internet sales tax? Is it good for the little guy that you don't have to pay sales tax, or is it bad for the local small business owner?
It's a really tricky question, because a question of fairness, I think, ought to be part of a free market libertarian economic policy. For me, it was just so telling how it was a stalemate while it was Walmart versus Amazon, and then once Amazon joined Walmart, then the tax passed. So I mostly use it as a tale in this is how policy gets made. As far as what the correct policy is, it's another one where
I think that you have to sort of say people who benefit from this are the ones who are actually, you know, you're living in a neighborhood, you're selling in that neighborhood. That's the way that we ought to have, you know, sort of a fair tax policy. And I think that, you know, the ENZ approach is exactly wrong from that perspective in terms of favoring the bigs.
Here, also following up on taxes, because, part of the libertarian populist platform seems to be a flat tax and certainly simplifying the tax code. But then you get assailed by kind of big, establishment Republicans saying, okay, well, that's the biggest write-off for wealthy people. How do you respond to those kinds of questions?
Well, okay, so I don't think a flat tax needs to be the priority. I think if you have a flat tax, once you have an exemption, if you think about it, it's progressive, because it's 15% on every dollar above the exemption or whatever percentage. So the idea of a progressive rate is something that almost anybody, if you buy into an income tax with an exemption, you're buying into a progressive rate. And I definitely think you have to buy into the exemption. The stupidest argument Republicans lay out is that you need to be taxed on the first dollar, sort of the Michelle Bachmann argument that it's a crime that there are people who aren't paying income tax. So a big, juicy exemption
actually,
down there.
Actually, I think there's a crime. It's a crime that people aren't avoiding income
yes.
tax.
Yes. So a giant, juicy exemption, and then if the rates are progressive, that doesn't bother me, and that's another example of shifting the priorities. What bothers me is the complexity which rigs the game in favor of the people who can afford to hire the former chief of staff to the Ways and Means Committee.
John Wharton, when I heard the topic of today's discussion, I had a little alarm bell go off in me, and you mentioned why, and his name is Huey Long. When we talk about populism, the temptation is always that someone is going to rise up like Huey Long or like Barack Obama and say, you can trust me because I'm a friend of the little guy. And then, of course, we come to realize that all he's doing is building his power base with those who are less sophisticated as to the kinds of manipulations that real political professionals know how to do very well and get funded by the big boys on K Street. So what I, as a libertarian, am looking for is the kind of leader who would actually build in his own self-destruction along the lines of a Tom Coburn, whom I think is a great guy, and I'd like to see more politicians like him, who has, I believe, restricted himself, and I think he's going to be good to his word, to what, 2 terms, and he's gone, and he will not extend that. But my concern is that a Rand Paul will just be building another sort of power base, another layer of sophistication, another game to play on the American people. So how is libertarian populism any different? How can we protect against this? How can we maintain the ideals of small government?
I just want to throw out the idea again that movement building is more important than, you know, finding the right politician to back. I mean, having the ability to pressure politicians and not putting all your eggs in the basket of Huey Long or Earl Long or Alfalfa Bill Murray or whichever whichever populist politician you're thinking of.
Yeah, and I would just add to that, I think the centerpiece of this is making the argument that a libertarian free market answer to these problems actually does favor the little guy in a way that the existing superstructure of liberalism's game playing when it comes to the subsidization side, or the Republican sort of technocratic, we can do the life of Julia except a little bit cheaper and a little bit more efficiently, which is just not, from my perspective, a long-term viable alternative.
Let's have one more question.
Yeah, Steve Allen, Capital Research Center. At the risk of sounding like the geezer who walked 3 miles to school in the snow and so forth, I would point out that people have thought about this before. I worked in the Reagan campaign in 76, and we had brochures that were attacking big business, big labor, and big government, and that was the formula that we used. And then after Reagan lost the nomination, a lot of people came back, and there was a group called the Libertarian Republican Alliance, where I was on the advisory board with a physician named Ron Paul. So there were a lot of people talking about this. In fact, Richard Viguerie and I brought a copy in case nobody believed me. Richard Viguerie wrote a piece for the Washington Post attacking Reagan for not going far enough in this direction. 1983, America's ruling class has got to go.
We were talking about earlier about the sugar issues. That's Reagan. Reagan signed that.
Exactly. So I guess my question is, do you think the stars have sort of aligned now with the everything from the big bank bailout to the mess in foreign policy to give an opportunity to libertarian populism that maybe didn't exist in recent years?
First of all, if this were a new idea, that would be the surest guarantee that it was wrong. As Nick said, I'm a conservative. And so, but yes, the stars have kind of aligned. The bailout, okay, I wrote a book in 2006, The Big Ripoff, which is actually better than the book I wrote in 2009, but nobody bought it because nobody like, I'd have TV hosts being like, wait, are you the conservative or the liberal? And then after 2008, everybody realized the bailouts, Obama got more money from Goldman Sachs than any other company ever did. Obamacare was this corporatist love fest, the stimulus, et cetera. And so 2010 was the real point where the stars were most aligned. Then the Republicans nominated Mitt Romney. The fact that that was a failure means that it's possible that they will realign. I mean, some of what my job is predicting the future of politics, and I do think that the things can possibly line up now, and whether they will or not, I'd say less than 50%, but better than previously.
I'm not sure that the stars have aligned, but I do think that it's more promising now than it was then, in a sense, because I think people have seen the lessons of failure from the other side. And I think that that's the lesson both of leftist failure and of rightist failure in terms of this approach to governance. And I think that people are frankly ripe for something new. They want to have hopes in something new. And I think this does have a sort of newness to it, in the sense that it hasn't been tried yet to the degree that you were sort of working on to that stage, or that we're talking about now.
Jesse, do you have anything to?
I'm not an astrologer. I don't know if the stars are aligned or not. So.
Talk a little bit though, possibly about drawing from kind of past experiences. Is there a generational shift going on? Because one of the things that's interesting is a couple of months ago, I guess at this point, the College Republican National Committee sponsored a study, a survey of millennials, 18 to 29-year-old voters. And one of the questions they asked these people was, name the next generation of leaders in the Republican Party and in the Democratic Party. Who are the future leaders? And in the Republican Party, they were talking about people like Ted Cruz, Marco Rubio, Nikki Haley, Rand Paul, Justin Amash, Susana Martinez. I mean, there were a number of people who were under the age of 60 there. When it came to the Democrats, they were like, well, there's Hillary Clinton, maybe Cory Booker. Are there shifts in American politics where it's actually more age-based and kind of generational, and that maybe this is what we're seeing, is that Obama, even though he's relatively young as a president, is the end of an era, of a post-war era that really did celebrate bigness, and we're now moving into a kind of transpartisan phase towards a kind of populist understanding of things.
You know, when I became sort of libertarian in the late 80s, there was this whole big thing about how the boomers were the new libertarian generation. And then in the 90s, I remember USA Today doing a big story on how Generation X was the libertarian generation, and now apparently the millennials are going to be the libertarian generation. And the positive spin is maybe the world is just getting more libertarian, and each generation makes the old generation look like a bunch of fogies. But I get really skeptical about these generational generalizations. I will say this, that if you look at sort of the periods when there's this sort of burst of individualism and challenges to entrenched institutional power of all kinds, big government and others. They tend to fall, at least in the last century, into two sort of categories. There's the periods like the 20s and the 90s where it's between crises. People turn inward. There's not a big war or a depression that can give people an excuse for assembling power. And as a result, there's this sort of decadent flowering of individualism, right? And I'm decadent, I don't just mean in a sort of countercultural way. I just mean in the sense that you can't be sort of brought into these big projects. The other is times like the 1970s and now, when there's just so many crushing failures of institutional power that you're in the midst of the crisis and everything has failed. I mean, and this whole sort of the series of Iraq, Katrina, the 2008 collapse, I mean, one after another, and then Obama doing the same stuff that Bush did, that opens up a different sort of space, which I think is a lot bleaker, and it opens up space for other things besides libertarianism as well. I think we've all seen this, but it's that sort of opportunity is on our plate right now.
But it also could turn out to be something along the lines of the 1830s, where you have the breakdown of these vast institutions, but in a surprising sort of flowering in response to that of healthier communities that actually can work together. Hey, guess what? Maybe we don't need to have these overarching big institutions in order to hold things together. Maybe we can take care of ourselves. And so I think that's kind of the optimism behind it.
Okay, well, we will leave it there for today. I want to thank Jesse Walker of Reason, Ben Domenech of The Transom and of Real Clear Politics and of Heartland Institute, Tim Carney of The Washington Examiner, and several books, one of which is much better than the other. So go back to your Amazon and get that. And I'm Nick Gillespie for Reason and Reason TV. Thanks all for coming.